From Voltaire to Joseph Heller, writers have used satire to skewer institutions and individuals. Historian Barbara Tuchman observed that satire is a wrapping of exaggeration around a core of reality. The subversive nature of satire has long made it a favorite tool of the powerless and of those wishing to humble the mighty. Not surprisingly, many politicians and leaders do not see the humor, and they take issue with these purveyors of parody, believing instead that they are being mocked. The Monitor's Stephen Humphreys writes today about the end of The Late Show with Stephen Colbert at a moment when political satire has become increasingly partisan. It's Thursday, May 21st. This is the Monitor Daily Podcast. Good morning. I'm April Austin. First, our curation of news briefs from our writers around the world. Many of these are developing stories. Find the latest updates at csmonitor.com/newsbriefs or on our app. The U.S. indicted former Cuban leader Raul Castro. In announcing the indictments, centered on the Cuban military's 1996 downing of two civilian aircraft that killed four Cuban Americans, Acting Attorney General Todd Blanche told reporters that the United States does not and will not forget its citizens. The Justice Department appears to be working from a 2003 case pressing charges over the Cuban military action. Mr. Castro, brother of longtime Cuban leader Fidel Castro, was defense minister at the time of the shootdowns. The Cuban government argued then that the planes were operated by anti-Cuban activists undertaking military action. January 6th, police officers sued to block the Trump administration's $1.776 billion anti-weaponization fund. The fund aims to compensate people the Justice Department says were wrongly treated by the U.S. government, likely including allies of President Donald Trump. The officers, who defended the Capitol against rioters on January 6, 2021, say the fund violates the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, which bans the use of federal money to pay any debt or obligation incurred in aid of insurrection or rebellion against the United States. Also, the European Union is moving forward on its trade deal with the U.S. The deal was agreed to last year in response to President Trump's broad tariff threats. But Mr. Trump's recent spat with Europe, promising to remove troops and raise tariffs on European automakers to 25%, raised questions about whether Europe would abandon the deal. Mr. Trump appears to have backed off his threats to raise tariffs on European automakers, and the EU felt abiding by the deal was an important statement of principle. A deal is a deal, and the EU honors its commitments, European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen said on social media on Tuesday. Now, today's Monitor stories. As always, you can go to csmonitor.com or our app for the latest news. The Late Show with Stephen Colbert found success as it became more political and biting at a moment of polarization. Can humor still bring us together? Stephen Humphreys reports for The Monitor. An overwhelming majority of Democrats now view Israel negatively, a dramatic shift that is playing out in primary campaigns across the country. It could portend big changes in policy, should the party capture control of Congress. Simon Montlake reports from Detroit, Michigan, for The Monitor. Argentina's overhauled labor law is meant to modernize the workforce and loosen the grip of historically powerful unions. But in an administration focused on cost-cutting, some workers find the legislation is one shock too many. Contributor Constance Malloray reports from Buenos Aires for The Monitor. The Trump administration has reached an unusual settlement in a case of the president suing his own government. Critics worry that a resulting anti-weaponization fund will be ripe for abuse, benefiting President Donald Trump, his family, and his allies. Henry Gass reports for The Monitor. Iran's wartime viral social media campaign has been slick, savvy, and accessible to a Western audience. Despite the White House's focus on online messaging, Iran seems to have caught the United States completely off guard. Scott Peterson and Caitlin Babcock report from London and Washington for The Monitor. Now, commentary from The Monitor's editorial board on the vital voice of Congress in launching war. Americans are contending with almost daily shifts in how the Trump administration characterizes the war/ceasefire with Iran that began February 28th. Yet just as important to this current Middle East struggle is a series of resolutions proposed in Congress to either end the conflict or seek approval by lawmakers to continue it. On Tuesday, in its eighth such vote since strikes against Iran began, the Senate advanced a measure to debate a requirement of the 1973 War Powers Resolution that a president obtain congressional approval within 60 days of starting a conflict. The House is expected to vote shortly on a similar measure for the fourth time. The administration contends that the requirement is unnecessary, as a ceasefire announced April 7th reset the 60-day clock. Many Capitol Hill observers believe it is unlikely that a resolution forcing the president to cease hostilities with Iran will pass either the House or the Senate, or if it does, will bypass a presidential veto. Does that mean the practice of raising multiple resolutions and lawmakers' pronouncements on the issue is merely performative politicking? Or is there value for Americans in continued deliberation, especially with a focus on the constitutional mandate that only Congress, not the Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces, can declare war, as stated in Article 1, Section 8? In April, a bipartisan group of 63 former state and national officials urged Congress to reaffirm its role in matters of war and peace. They cited survey data that 66% of Americans support congressional approval for acts of war, and that 78% believe congressional oversight strengthens our political system. They also noted a need to review the War Powers Resolution, which they said allows for ambiguous interpretations. Democrat Tim Kaine of Virginia, a resolution sponsor in the Senate, has said he wants to ensure we have a real debate about whether it's in our national interest to continue this war. But critics argue that presidents should have leeway to make real-time decisions to counter actual or anticipated threats. Requiring congressional approval before or even during such operations, they say, can compromise success or constrain presidents' decision-making options at a cost to American lives and interests. According to analyst Stephen Pomper, who served in both the George W. Bush and Barack Obama administrations, leaders from both parties have ignored the 1973 War Powers Act for decades. There is a need, he wrote in Foreign Affairs, to restore scrutiny or accountability when it comes to the most lethal and consequential actions the United States can take. The point of forcing the president to come to Congress isn't to guarantee good outcomes, Mr. Pomper observed. It is to produce debate, insert a speed bump on the way to elective war, and require elected representatives to take a stand for which they will be judged at the ballot box. Starting a hot war needs the cool consensus of Congress to ensure the broad support of Americans and to boost the morale of soldiers on the front lines. In the current armed standoff with Iran over its nuclear ambitions, U.S. lawmakers, elected by American citizens, are at the top of the political chain of command. The stories you just heard are from today's newsletter, Find these stories and more at csmonitor.com or on our app. For more Monitor podcasts, go to csmonitor.com/podcasts. For other audio offerings from our parent organization, go to christianscience.com/audio. Today's Christian Science Spiritual Perspective contributor shares how the understanding that there is only one soul, God, and that each of us is a reflection of soul, frees and heals us. Find the full column at csmonitor.com/csperspective. Thanks to today's audio production team, Mackenzie Farkas, Noel Flatt, and Victoria Hoffman.
This podcast is produced by the Christian Science Monitor in Boston, Massachusetts, USA. Copyright 2026.